Good afternoon, everyone. This is a formal rulemaking hearing held pursuant to Section 244.103 of the State Administrative Procedure Act. The date is September 2nd, 2008, and the time is 2:04 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room on the second floor of the Office of the Secretary of State at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting the hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Mike Hoffman. This hearing is in accordance with the notice of rulemaking that was published in the Colorado Register on August 10th, 2008. Other people from the Secretary of State's office that I'd like to introduce to my immediate right is Christy Hebbard, who's in charge of special projects for the Elections Division, which includes the lobbyist program. To my immediate left now is Andrea Geiger, legal specialist with the Elections Division. And actually, in the back of the room, we have Angela Lawson, who is in charge of our lobbyist program, and Troy Bratton, who is a legal specialist with the Elections Division. There are sign-up sheets on the table for anyone who wishes to testify, and also copies of materials, including the latest version of the proposed rules. Again, the purpose of the hearing today is to receive comments on the proposed rules. I'd like to give a little bit of background about the proposed rules. We initiated rulemaking primarily because of a performance audit that was conducted by the State Auditor's Office and released in May of 2008. The audit made a number of recommendations about the lobbyist regulation program, including recommendations concerning rulemaking as well as legislation. So and the rules had not been, the Secretary of State's rules had not been amended since 2001. So they were in need of a review. In the proposed rules, there's a number of things that were identified in the performance audit that are being addressed. One is a definition of bona fide personal emergency as recommended by the State Auditor. Another is a definition of substantial violation, which is also a recommendation of the State Auditor. That's a term that really relates to the circumstances under which the Secretary of State is required to report violations of the lobbyist law to the legislative leadership under Section 24-6-305, subsection 4, I believe. So there's a fair amount of reorganization of the rules. The statute essentially requires a rule that concerns what types of records lobbyists must retain. There's a requirement for mandatory electronic filing with a hardship exception that is based on Section 24-21-111, which was actually a statute enacted several years ago and initiated by the Joint Budget Committee to encourage electronic filing for all of the programs conducted by the Secretary of State's office. I think for some time, well over 95% of all lobbyists file electronically anyway. There were a number of, or several changes to the original proposed rules that we published on July 31st, and I'd like to call attention to those changes. So the version that we published and distributed last week that I'd like to work off of today, which is dated August 28th, one of the major changes had to do with the record retention rule, and I believe, if I can find that, and on the August 28th version, that's on page 8 out of 10, it's Rule 5. A couple of rules were essentially deleted. There, what is stricken on lines 20 through 24 There was a concern that those rules were overly broad and burdensome, and so there has been an attempt to try to cut back and be more clear about what kinds of records must be retained by lobbyists. I'm really hoping to get some comment today about whether that's better or in need of further improvement. But that was one of the major changes. There was also another major change had to do with legislative liaisons or state liaisons who work for state government. Each principal department is required to designate one person, and the proposed rules define that person to be a state liaison. And new rule 4.2, proposed new rule 4.2 at the bottom of page 7 and the top of page 8, is intended to clarify some questions that arose about the responsibilities of the state liaison. I think that's the gist of the background and my introductory remarks. As I said, I think the main purpose is to get some feedback on the rules. We do have some written comments that we've received, but we do have at least a couple of people signed up to testify. So when you come forward, please identify who you represent, if anyone, and give us your testimony. It is a recorded meeting, and we are also broadcasting over the Internet. Diane Orff. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Diana Orff. I am here representing myself today. I previously submitted written comments which were directed to the July 31st proposed rule. That set of comments was endorsed by a number of individuals. However, since I'm looking at a new revision and I have not shared my discussion with anyone else at this point, please let the record reflect that I represent myself and I don't think you should attribute my comments necessarily to those other individuals. Certainly the revised rule is better, and I will add, I am a professional lobbyist that is registered closing for about 25 years. I'm also a licensed attorney in Colorado, so I have a dual set of concerns. With regard to the records retention, and that really is the only part of the rule I would comment on, paragraph D, I understand where that's coming from. Paragraph E is replacing previous language that we had felt was overbroad. I believe paragraph E is still somewhat vague. I think lobbyists, just because of the nature of the legislative business and the rulemaking process, will keep a variety of records. What issues or legislation is lobbied is a direct result of interaction with clients. So to the extent that we maintain records or have to turn records over or retain those, it does still have the ability, I believe, to reflect a client's business strategy, perhaps confidential information. Some of the issues I'd pointed out in written comments, while paragraph E as revised is better, I think there is still a potential problem there. A vast amount of communication can be used in determining whether to lobby an issue or not. If contracts are to be retained, contracts may range from being a very definite charge to go forward and support or oppose a specific bill. It may be also a very broad charge to cover anything and everything that could potentially affect a client's business or a trade association's interest. So, you know, when I first looked at it, I said, does this mean that I attach the full status sheet? Because, in fact, we read every bill twice. and we may follow amendments to see if it is going to impact a client's business. We may not lobby the bill. Part of the concern is we don't know what monitoring means. And right now on the lobby report, there is an option. You can say you're supporting, opposing, amending, monitoring. Monitoring is a thought process in many cases. So do we disclose every bill that we read that might affect a client? Do we report only those bills that we initiate communication with covered officials on? I think that is part of our problem. We're still not sure what we're supposed to keep. I don't want to rent a warehouse for records, if I can help it. But as I think you previously noted, with electronic filing, much of this information is also electronic. So I think it is still overbroad. I think it's possible to hone it down a bit to make it more specific. I think if we're specific, perhaps just to those bills supported and opposed, that kind of brings the universe in. And it doesn't get into the thought process and the discussion with clients that is necessarily part of determining what eventually gets lobbied. So that is a concern that I would share with you. I think it's an improvement, but I think there's a ways to go yet. And as an attorney, as you know, legislation sometimes results in administrative actions at an agency level, which includes the practice of law, and it also can get into litigation eventually. And so then you have basically prior work product that gets caught up in the confidentiality issue. So, those are my comments. I think it needs a little bit more work, doable, but I think it's still overly broad.
Diana, if I could ask a couple
Certainly.
Of questions. Obviously, the attempt when we were narrowing from the original proposal down to just the records that were used in preparing the statements, the idea would be hopefully to get away from, strategy papers and
sure.
things that analyses and so forth. But one of the things I hear you saying is even then, since you have to I want to make sure I have this right, since you have to say whether you're supporting or opposing a bill, that could bring in those very same documents. Is that right?
I believe it could bring in the same documents. Maybe we could craft a way around it, but to me, the other piece there that makes it problematic is the monitoring designation. What does monitoring mean? I don't think that's defined anywhere, and to me, it's monitoring isn't lobbying until you communicate, because lobbying is defined as communication. So if I go sit in on a hearing because I think somebody might be interested in it, and I ask somebody a question about it later, is that lobbying? Do I have to disclose that, or do I have to put that on a list somewhere? To me, that's still somewhat unclear.
You know, and one of the things that I haven't looked at very carefully yet is what's the consequence of a rule that requires certain documents to be retained? I think it's pretty clear that Section 304 requires rules that designate what it is, what record, like the statute says records have to be retained for 5 years, but it leaves it up to the rules to say what records. But I guess I don't recall much in the statute that says so what. I'm aware, for example, that in the next section the Secretary of State can investigate lobbyists, and I assume that might include asking for those records that are required to be retained. I don't recall seeing anything else that requires disclosure of those records to others, although that it might be there. I just don't recall seeing it. You happen to know? I mean, I'm trying to think through also
right.
just what types of risks a rule like this would expose lobbyists to. Could, for example, if it's just the Secretary of State investigating, could the Secretary of State keep those records confidential?
Well, you know, that's one of the questions that I had raised in the written comments, is because once they arrive at the Secretary of State's office, I would presume that to be an open record.
Well, I know there is an exception for investigatory, I can't say the word, but for those types of documents. I don't know for sure that it applies to this situation, but it might as an exception under the Open Records Act.
So that could remove a potential concern with disclosure of client information, business secrets, etc. I think the risk to the lobbyist more than a financial penalty is the risk of damaged professional reputation or having not retained something or arguably disposed of it when they shouldn't have. We all want to follow the rules if the rules are clear.
And I've assumed up till now at least that the purpose of record retention was to provide some backup for the disclosure reports. I'm just inferring that. Hence the idea to limit what has to be retained to just those records that relate to that. But how do you avoid being overly broad, because those records can have a lot of information that don't really relate to what's disclosed on the regular reports at all? And I don't know. I'm certainly fishing for suggestions.
I think other than simply a numerical listing, which is exactly what we file, I don't know how you go beyond that.
With respect to the attorney-client privileges, I also wonder if that still could be asserted, even if the rule requires retaining certain records that might constitute attorney-client privilege, that could still be asserted, do you think?
Rule 5.7 of attorneys' professional rules of conduct appeared to give some leeway there, but it is also dependent on the reasonable efforts or reasonable ability to advise the client that the information might not be privileged. In the context of the legislation itself, that may be correct. If you take it down the line 1 or 2 years where there may be subsequent administrative agency action or litigation, then I think that is not clear that it is not privileged. So it's all one big ball of wax at some point. And that's my concern, that this just doesn't sort it out very well. You made a great attempt in trying to narrow it down. I just don't think we're there yet.
And it sounds like you don't have an issue with A or B, I believe, as proposed.
No, that's very clear cut.
And tell me again about C, contracts.
If contracts have to be maintained, I personally don't have any problem with that.
Could be, like, again, for the lawyers, there could be a retainer agreement or something, but that
and
in
that
itself
could be very broad. That mm-hmm. could be very broad. Maybe it may say issues X, Y, and Z.
That would not
and
pose
I don't,
problem.
And I, no, it wouldn't bother me personally. I would back up. I think if people knew that was subject to disclosure under the law, then that might be able to be handled. But I think there might be some privilege asserted at the point that those records were requested. But keeping the records is not a problem, at least for those three items. Disclosing them might become a problem.
Sure. Okay. I don't have any other questions, so thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Greg Romberg. Anybody who's joined us wishes to testify, we do have a sign-up sheet on the edge of the table here. Good afternoon.
Hi. Thank you. I'm Greg Romberg. I'm a registered professional lobbyist since 1994, and I was a state employee both before and after. started registering starting in 1981. I want to reiterate much of what you heard from Ms. Orff, and I actually was one of the people who signed onto the letter that she had prepared and agreed with that. I also want to reiterate how much I appreciate the work that had been done based on what you saw in that letter and how much better I think this looks. Just a couple points in general I wanted to make. One is, I wonder in some ways if it, and this may be as much as I just said I wanted to reiterate, this may be counter, but I wonder if there may be some benefit in looking at this as much of a performance standard as looking for specific things, and that, you know, I know what I put together every time to have my report to get what I'm required by law to put in, and if you came to ask me why my report that I filed this morning said what it said, I could show you that. So you may want to look at a performance-based standard as opposed to something so specific, and that might work. The other thing I just wanted to mention in passing a little bit is that I think most people are aware that last year there was some discussion primarily by Representative Marshall about looking at trying to spend some more time about what was legislative work product and keeping that kind of information quiet. My clients include the media, and I was involved in those discussions quite extensively. And I think there's a little bit of a disconnect in legislative thought process on these issues in that, on one hand, the legislation that we had a couple of years ago related to lobbyists, and it ties to what Ms. Orff was talking about as far as are we supporting or monitoring or amending or opposing, and wanting things to look more available. On the same hand, some of those people who were very assertive about that bill then wanted legislative work product to afford them things not showing up in reports that I think by law, with the change in the statute, do show up in our report. So just as you're looking at those issues, I think we're a little, I think we from a public policy perspective are still trying to find our way through these issues. And then again, just as an aside, not specifically related to the rulemaking, but the point that was made previously, I find monitoring very confusing too. And I make the same distinction that was made here previously, is that if I'm monitoring from a distance, I don't report it. But once I communicate with a covered official, but I'm not taking an actual position. But I think in some ways the difficulty you have is the difficulty we all have in understanding what the public policy intent on everything we're working with is. But thanks for changing what you did change based on our comments.
Do you think that there's really any need for, you know, as far as Rule 5 is concerned, anything beyond A, B, C, and D? I mean, I'm really wondering if that's, I mean, what part of what I'm hearing is you're already reporting the position on the bills to the best of your ability in good faith, and beyond that, I mean, we've got the receipts for expenditures or contributions, the documentation of income, contracts. I mean, I do wonder if anything more would be helpful to anyone as far as backup documentation for the reports that are filed.
My sense is going beyond what you're talking about right there. Would take us beyond what we're required to report under the law, so that if we have enough to be able to provide you information to show why what our report said, I think that complies with the legislative intent. I think that the Secretary would have done what he needs to gather that information. I think that might be a good way to go.
All right. Anything else? All right. Thank you very much. I don't have anyone else signed up. Yes, sir, then come forward. Sorry. You'll identify who you are and who
sure,
you represent.
I will sign up, too. I'm sorry that I'm late, and I'm sorry that I've sort of dressed appropriately to be in the meeting today.
Fine.
Be it. I also have been a lobbyist at the Capitol since about 1983 or so I've seen a lot of the changes that have happened. I want to agree with both my colleagues.
Oh, I'm sorry, just for the record, go ahead.
My name is Jim Cole, C-O-L-E. I think I'd be more practiced at this, given that I've But I don't often find myself in front of the microphone. As you're starting to draw lines to pare this back, I very much appreciate that. In the context of, I still don't sort of understand from your your statement of basis and purpose, sort of what the public policy objective is, other than to, as you said, Mr. Hobbs, to sort of put some flesh on the bones of the legislature saying, according to the rules established by the Secretary of State. And so I'm still kind of wondering what's broken in the context of now that we're disclosing what we're reporting on, what positions our clients are taking, who we're working for, and so forth, and all of that is pretty much available electronically. I think that the legislature, who, when these rules and these new laws started floating out, their concern was who's lobbying me about what for what purpose. And I think we've kind of gotten there. And so in some ways, sort of formalizing the practice of our disclosure is probably a good thing. As you go farther, for those of us that aren't lawyers, the law of unintended consequences start to present itself. Do now I pull an attorney in on staff and hire them? Do I always try to fly under the cloak of attorney-client privilege? Because I'm told that attorneys don't have to register as lobbyists. They're regulated someplace else. And so as you push forward for higher degrees of disclosure, we may actually be having the unintended consequence of pushing things in the opposite direction. In that context. So I just want you to be mindful of that, as I'm sure you are. I also have a number of hats. I'm a contract lobbyist, so I do sort of soup to nuts, everything from banking to oil and gas to higher education and so forth. So I've got a lot of different sort of irons and different fires at any one time. But one of the things that's confusing me a little bit is the need for the addition of persons lobbying on behalf of an institution, a governing board of higher ed. As you add that, I'm still trying to figure out how in the statute it looks to me like there's an exemption for covered state officials if you're lobbying as a contract lobbyist. So are you still covered by this if I'm a contract higher ed lobbyist? I would argue that you're not. That there's a specific statutory, as I read it, maybe somebody can help me understand. I'm much better at, you know, making up the law than I am interpreting it. No, I'm kidding, for the record. but it seems to me that there's some circularity there. And then even if you are, then you get down to the disclosure statements for those covered state officials. If I'm a contract that's not by definition a state official, am I out, or am I, if I'm in, am I only covered to disclose legislation and the public funds expended? But there again, on the item 3, it says the time of estimating, lobbying, and so forth. That seems to me to be kind of overreach with that, especially given that circularity that I've described, because the statute seems to say if I'm already registered, then I don't have to buy. If I'm already registered as a contract lobbyist, then I don't need to then file another form as working for a higher ed institution as a contract lobbyist. So I guess my suggestion would be to strike that. I know that you're trying to pull that in together, but I think it's already covered between the current regs and the statute. Let's see. And there are also a couple of different kinds of higher ed lobbyists. There's a kind that are employed directly, where they get their salary and their benefits. Then there's a kind that's paid for by the institution, but there's still a contract. And then there's kind of a third kind that's hired by the foundation or a separate third party that is out there that is still sort of another netherland. But from my practice, we disclose sort of all of our contracts, what those amounts are, who are we working for, and the bills that we're involved in. And so from a public policy perspective, again, I'm having difficulty understanding why we're trying to throw in sort of higher ed, because I think that higher ed is covered under the current statute and the way you've implemented the rules. So I would suggest striking that, unless maybe I don't understand why that's what loose end you're trying to tie up there.
Well, Jim, I'm glad you brought that up. Let me take a run at that, because on the one hand, I think I hear we do need to take a look at the higher ed lobbyists who are not employees and make sure that we're properly addressing that group. But at least from the point of view of the proposed rules, the references to people that are lobbying on behalf of institutions and governing boards was just trying to be consistent with Section 303.5, and that's the section that deals with the requirement that each principal department designate a state liaison who's responsible, and I need to pull this up here, but I think it says that person is responsible for the lobbying on behalf of the principal department. And then, as I recall, it kind of treats the people lobbying on behalf of institutions of higher education and governing boards separately, as if they're not under the umbrella of the state liaison, that they're independent of that, with the assumption, therefore, that they would still be required to register, I think. At least that was my understanding. But they wouldn't be covered by the state liaison. So the proposed rule was simply trying to be, I think, consistent with the language in 303.5.
And I would try to point you then to 303.5 sub 3, and maybe you can help. And that's where I think we're already covered, in the sense that I think that exemption in there is for the contract lobbyists who are already registered and complying elsewhere. So the issue, I think, is already covered in statute in that context. So that's why I'm trying to point that up, that says that you're not a state official or an employee, and I think that's who the upper part of that was trying to cover, with those official people. And then it says that I think 3 is an exception, unless you're already registered. And that's how I think it was put together, to try to say, if you're already a contract lobbyist working for state government or higher ed, and you're already doing this complying with the other portions of the statute, then you don't have to do that. And so that's why I'm coming back with the suggestion of it's already covered in that sense. So because what I'm trying to do from an implementation, as Diana said, standpoint, is I want to be in compliance, but as I'm complying sort of with the name, rank, and serial number as a contract lobbyist, and then I have a contract with a state agency or a state higher ed in this case, then doing it yet another sort of separate reporting along those lines, to me, that to me doesn't make sense. And so I'm suggesting we may already be covered from a contract standpoint.
Well, at the risk of belaboring this one, I need to just go off and look at this.
Okay.
I do see 303.5 in subsection 1 says that there has to be a person responsible for lobbying by a state official or employee on behalf of said principal department. And there's where that phrase comes in, a state official or employee, which in subsection 3 is defined to exclude a contract lobbyist. But then it goes on to say that all designated persons, referring to the person designated by each principal department, as well as any person lobbying on behalf of an institution or governing board, shall register with the Secretary of State. And so I'm assuming that the contract lobbyists would be excluded, exempted, but the employee lobbyists, if you will, people who are employed by the state government to lobby on behalf of an institution or a governing board, would be required to register by this.
Bingo. That's how I'm reading.
Okay. Good. Okay.
Which is why I sort of think that it's already within the boundaries of statute, but the new language and persons and lobbying behalf, I think, shall fulfill the requirements. I just want to make sure that the exemption then applies in the context of the contract.
Okay.
Because I don't want to get into the gotcha of how did I comply later on, creating a problem for you.
And you're also trying to avoid basically duplicate registration and reporting.
Absolutely,
right?
Every month, because we spend since the law passed about how much we are actually, which bills, whether we're monitoring, updating those changes. I bet my office, we spend probably close to, at the beginning of the session, 120, 140 man hours just sitting down and going through the spreadsheets and marking it in. Your website sort of takes one bill at a time. It'd be great if we could give you an Excel spreadsheet and kind of be done with it. But the amount of time we have to spend there, you get about 6 records, and if you don't hit the save button, then you got to start over. It's not necessarily a complaint. I'm just trying to say, if that's the way it has to be done, so be it. Just don't make me do it twice. And that's all I have to say.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else wish to testify? If not, I'm going to close the rulemaking hearing, but I'm going to leave the rulemaking record open.
Do we have any deadlines, Andrea?
By the 10th.
So by close of business on Friday?
I'll leave the rulemaking record open until close of business on Friday. And so for anybody who would like to submit comments in writing, anybody here or anybody listening, please do so by 5 o'clock on Friday. And I would love to see more written comments. I know since we changed the proposal just last week, people really haven't had an opportunity to look at the revisions. So I would welcome more comments. I would really welcome any suggested language that anyone might offer. That would be very helpful. So with that, if there's no other testimony, then I'll note for the record that the time is 2:40 p.m. and we are adjourned. Thank you.